This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In today's program, you can hear our feature, The African Synod, The Church Alive in Africa Today. First, however, our bulletin of church news, followed by Africa News Panorama. We shall close today's program with Millennium Appointment. I am Festus Tarawali. The Holy See Press Office on Sunday evening released the first photograph of Pope Francis since his hospitalization at Rome's Gemelli Hospital on the 14th of February. The photo shows the Pope in prayer after concelebrating Mass. In the picture, taken from behind, the Pope is shown wearing a purple stole, typical of Lenten liturgical vestments, and sitting in a wheelchair before the altar of the chapel on the 10th floor of the hospital. Pope Francis has gone to pray every day at the chapel since the reported slight improvements in his medical condition. In its update on Saturday evening, the Holy See Press Office said the clinical condition of the Holy Father remained stable, confirming the progress observed in the past week. High-flow oxygen therapy continues, progressively reducing the need for non-invasive mechanical ventilation during the night, read the statement. The last photos of the Pope were distributed on the 14th of February following an audience with members of Spain's Gaudium et Spes Foundation at the Casa Santa Marta residence in the Vatican shortly before his hospitalization. Also, since then, the Pope's voice was heard once in an audio clip played on the 6th of March during the Rosary prayer in St. Peter's Square, where he blessed the faithful and thanked those who have prayed for him during this time of illness. This Monday evening's Holy Rosary for the health of the Pope will be led by Cardinal Dominique Mamberti, the prefect of the Supreme Tribunal of the Apostolic Signatura. The Marian prayer will begin at 19:30 local time in St. Peter's Square. For the first time, the Friday Lenten sermons for the Roman Curia this year are open to anyone who wishes to participate, and no tickets are required. That's according to an announcement released on Monday morning by the prefecture of the papal household. The Lenten sermons will take place at 9 a.m. in the Paul VI Hall in the Vatican on the four Fridays leading to Holy Week beginning this Friday. Capuchin Franciscan Father Roberto Pasolini, preacher of the papal household, will lead the meditations on the theme, Anchored in Christ, Rooted and Founded in Hope of New Life. Specifically, Father Pasolini's sermons will reflect on the following sub-themes: Learning to Receive the Logic of Baptism on the 21st of March, Going Elsewhere, Freedom in the Spirit on the 28th of March, Knowing How to Rise Again, the Joy of Resurrection on the 4th of April, and Expanding Hope, the Responsibility of the Ascension on the 11th of April. As Christians prepare for Easter, Cardinal Claudio Guggerotti has urged Catholics across the world to contribute to the annual Good Friday collection, which directly supports the work of the Church in the Holy Land. As Devin Watkins reports, the prefect of the Dicastery for the Eastern Churches said the appeal connects us directly with the land trod by Jesus.
As Christians prepare spiritually for Easter during Lent, the prefect of the Dicastery for Eastern Churches has recalled the vital connection between faith and charity. Cardinal Claudio Guggerotti sent a letter to all Catholic bishops on Monday to invite them to promote the annual Good Friday collection taken up at the liturgy on that holy day. Each year, the faithful contribute money to support Christians in the Holy Land and the Church's mission to care for the places linked to Jesus' earthly life. In his letter, Cardinal Guggerotti urged Catholic bishops, in the name of the Holy Father, to convey the Church's appeal in response to the cry of those who are suffering so much. He said the ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war has halted the destruction that has killed tens of thousands of people in Gaza. Cardinal Guggerotti expressed the Church's hope in Christ's eternal victory over death, but noted that the Christians residing in the Holy Land require the concrete assistance of the Universal Church. He recalled Pope Francis's letter to Catholics of the Middle East sent on October 7, 2024, in which the Pope called them a seed loved by God. Cardinal Guggerotti urged Christians to remember our duty to help life be reborn, starting with rebuilding schools where children can learn and play together without the fear of seeing the satanic grin of death again. For us Christians, the holy places have a special value, he said. They are the incarnation of the incarnation. The Cardinal Prefect also thanked the Franciscan Friars Minor who have provided pastoral care through the custody of the Holy Land for centuries. Cardinal Guggerotti urged Catholic bishops to help remind Christians of our connection to the Holy Land and its people. At stake, he said, is the survival of this precious presence of ours, which dates back directly to the time of Jesus. I'm Devin Watkins.
Pope Francis, at the end of the text of his Angelus Reflection distributed on Sunday, renewed his appeal for prayers for peace, especially in countries wounded by war, citing tormented Ukraine, Palestine, Israel, Lebanon, Myanmar, Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Meanwhile, the UN says Sudan is facing the largest and most devastating humanitarian crisis in the world today. Fighting erupted in mid-April 2023 between the Sudan Armed Forces and the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. For more on the situation, here is Thaddeus Jones.
Some 30 million people in Sudan urgently need humanitarian aid, according to the UN, while five locations in the very large country are suffering famine. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell spoke on Thursday about the crisis when addressing the UN Security Council meeting on Sudan. She stated that nearly 2 years into the conflict, Sudan is now the largest and the most devastating humanitarian crisis in the world. She said with its economy and social service systems and infrastructures in near collapse and no end to this conflict in sight, she estimates that nearly two-thirds of the country's population will require humanitarian assistance this year, 16 million of whom are children. She warned that over 3 million children under the age of 5 are at imminent risk of deadly disease outbreaks, and she stressed that children in Sudan are enduring unimaginable suffering and horrific violence. She noted that despite these enormous challenges, UNICEF continues to respond wherever and however they can, delivering life-saving supplies and services in conflict hotspots, supporting displaced people and host communities, and building resilience. She noted that in 2024, UNICEF and those working with UNICEF reached over 9.8 million children and families with safe drinking water. They assisted 6.7 million children for malnutrition and provided life-saving treatment to close to 500,000 severely malnourished children as well. She said this critical outreach is essential, but by no means enough to protect all the children who are suffering in Sudan. She said the scale and gravity of the crisis require an immediate ceasefire and a resumption of political dialogue that can finally bring an end to the conflict. And she said if this can't be achieved immediately, temporary humanitarian pauses and localized ceasefires must be pursued urgently so children can be reached. In conclusion, she stressed that the world must stand united in calling for the protection of children there and the infrastructure they depend on to survive. As well, she said the Security Council needs to engage with and pressure all parties to ensure rapid, unimpeded, and safe movement of humanitarian workers and supplies across conflict lines. And she urgently called for a halt of all military support to the parties and instead encouraged them to engage in dialogue. In conclusion, she asked the Security Council to call on donors to ensure that UNICEF and all other humanitarian organizations can stay there and deliver essential, life-saving goods for children in Sudan. And only a massive mobilization of resources can save their lives and futures. I'm Thaddeus Jones.
You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
The government of Rwanda announced on Monday that it had cut diplomatic ties with Belgium and had given Belgian diplomats 48 hours to leave the country. A statement issued by Rwanda's Ministry of Foreign Affairs on Monday said Belgium had consistently undermined the country during the ongoing conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Indeed, the Belgian government has been leading calls for European countries to impose sanctions on Rwanda over its support for M23 rebels who have captured big parts of Congo. The statement noted that Belgium had clearly taken sides in a regional conflict and continues to systematically mobilize against Rwanda in different forums, using lies and manipulation to secure an unjustified hostile opinion of Rwanda in an attempt to destabilize both Rwanda and the region. Belgium is the former colonizer of Rwanda. It is in addition accused of arming Burundi to attack Rwanda and overthrow the government. Burundi sent troops to Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to fight the M23, but its troops have been scattered by the rebels and others taken as prisoners of war. Hundreds have run to the border town of Uvira, where they are preparing to put up the last stand before they retreat to Burundi. Reports from Senegal say the government has decided to charge former President Macky Sall after the Court of Auditors on the Management of Public Finances released a report 2 weeks ago citing corruption. Sall ruled Senegal from 2012 to 2024. The Court of Auditors said his government released false figures about expenditures, debt, and public deficit. The spokesman of the current Senegalese government, Mustafa Sarr, told reporters in Dakar that Mr. Sall takes full responsibility of the corruption that took place in his administration. Since leaving office last year, Mr. Sall transferred to Morocco, where he continues to live. Some of his former government officials have been investigated, prosecuted, and found guilty of corruption. They are serving long prison sentences. Reports from Somalia say government troops backed by the African Union force have been conducting land and air attacks against Al-Shabaab Islamic militants in the Busi Hareri area of Middle Shabelle province since Thursday last week. The attacks follow increase in Al-Shabaab attacks on Somali army bases. Government sources say more than 50 militants were killed at the weekend in the air strikes. Al-Shabaab has been fighting to capture government in Somalia and introduce radical Islam since 2006. It has officially declared that it is affiliated to the Al-Qaeda terrorist network.
The African Synod, the Church Alive in Africa Today.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali. This Wednesday, the 19th of March, the Feast of St. Joseph will mark the 12th anniversary of the inauguration of Pope Francis as the 256th successor of St. Peter, or the 266th Pope. Last Thursday, the 13th of March, the Pope marked the 12th anniversary of his election to the papacy in the company of the healthcare workers caring for him at Rome's Gemelli Hospital, where he is receiving treatment for double pneumonia. Shortly after the election of Jorge Mario Bergoglio as Pope 12 years ago, I rang Archbishop Gabriel Charles Pamabokul, the then Archbishop of Accra, Ghana, and then Treasurer of the Grouping of the Bishops' Conferences of Africa, known as SECAM, to get his reaction. In the interview recorded a few days into the papacy of Pope Francis, Most Reverend Pamabokul, who is currently the Archbishop of Cape Coast, told me at the time that the clergy, religious and lay faithful, are happy that a Pope had been elected within a short time and that he was pleasantly surprised at the Pope's choice of name. Well, quite a number of questions, you know. First one, Your Grace, is the inevitable question at this historic moment in the life of the Church, i.e. the election of Pope Francis as the 265th successor of St. Peter. I would like, first of all, to know, how has his election been received in Ghana, and what is your impression?
I will say that we were very happy that God gave us, within a very short time of conclave, a new pope in the person of Pope Francis, because all of us have been trained asking God to let us know whom he chooses to be the leader of our church. And so I can tell you all the bishops, all the priests, all the religious, and the lay faithful, we were all very happy to have a new pope within such a short time, and particularly for the pope to lead us through the Easter ceremonies. So I think we were very, very happy. Definitely there were some people who were, you know, hoping that it would have been our cardinal, but I don't think that that has been the overriding issue at all. For us, the overriding issue was we pray and ask God to give us the one he has chosen. And so Pope Francis is the one God has chosen. And so we were very happy to welcome him.
And so the name, of course, he said, he told journalists later that he chose the name Francis because of the 13th century saint's work for the poor, for creation and for peace. And he has also described, he has also been described, you know, as the humble and simple pope. How do you read this new disposition in a time when the church is facing so many challenges?
I would have to say that his name definitely came as a big and a pleasant surprise to most of us, because we had never heard Francis as Pope before. And so once he chose that name, I remember many of us started asking, oh, is he going to take after Saint Francis of Assisi? And he himself has told the whole world that he is taking after St. Francis of Assisi, and therefore has as an agenda a personality who is going to be humble, very approachable, somebody who would be peace-loving and working for peace, somebody who would work for a reform by reforming himself and by calling for personal conversion and reform. And I think that is what he has gradually been living up to in the first few days of his pontificate. In fact, I have taken as a cue for my Holy Week teachings what he said in the very first Sunday Mass he had in the parish of St. Anna in the Vatican. The last sentence he said, "The Lord is never tired of forgiving sins. It is we who are often tired to ask for forgiveness." And so he exhorts us to ask for God's forgiveness, because God is always willing and ready to forgive us. And I think it's a very interesting perspective he's bringing to us, for us to know that God is merciful and kind and is ready to welcome us any time at all. So we should rather go to God. You know, I think this already shows the impact that the new pope intends to make, what we call self-conversion, personal conversion, in order to reform the church, you know.
And the Africans, of course, feel, you know, a part of this papacy. For example, in the first general audience of Pope Francis, he made an appeal for an end to the crisis in the Central African Republic. And he has been speaking about how the church should go out and help the poor people. What's your perspective on that?
I know very well that the church in Africa is definitely the hope of the universal church. Already at the time of Pope Paul VI in 1969, when he visited, you know, Kampala, he said, "You Africans must be missionaries to yourselves," you know. And from that time on, the church has been growing in leaps and in bounds here in Africa. Pope John Paul II was one of those who created so many dioceses in Africa and visited the continent of Africa also, you know. And he gave us a lot of encouragement. In his time, we are told that the church grew from about 55 million Catholics to about 145 million Catholics. And then Pope Benedict XVI he went on to make a statement that I think is prophetic about Africa, namely that the church in Africa is the spiritual lungs of humanity. And he put it in the, you know, post-synodal exhortation, Africae Munus, number 177, saying that may the church in Africa continue to grow to become indeed one of the spiritual lungs of humanity. And may Africa bring her wealth and contribution into the universal church and to the whole world. So I believe very strongly that Pope Francis is only following in the good footsteps of his predecessors.
That was Archbishop Gabriel Charles Pamabokul of Cape Coast in Ghana. He was speaking to me there in the early days of Pope Francis's pontificate. And that's all for this edition of the African Synod, The Church Alive in Africa Today. Till the same time next week, I am Festus Tarawali.
And now, our feature Millennium Appointment. The Special Representative of the United Nations Secretary General on Violence Against Children, Dr. Najat Mala Mujeed, presented a report to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva last week, indicating a significant increase in child victims of trafficking over the last 5 years. The report is a product of a collaboration between her office and the agencies that defend the rights of children against violence and trafficking, which include states, governments, faith groups, human rights organizations, and civil society groups. In her address to the United Nations Human Rights Council, Dr. Mujeed disagreed with the usual quoted official figures that out of 10 victims of trafficking, 4 are children. She said the true number of children caught up in trafficking is much higher.
According to the latest global report on trafficking in persons, children account for 38% of victims detected globally, with a significant increase among girls. Trafficking in children intersects with other forms of violence, and children often experience multiple forms of abuse and exploitation before, during, and after being trafficked. The consequences of trafficking on children's family and entire communities are devastating and long-lasting, resulting in an intergenerational cycle of violence and social exclusion.
In simple words, human trafficking is the act of recruiting, transporting, transferring, harboring or receiving individuals through force, fraud or coercion for the purpose of exploitation. This exploitation includes forced labor, sexual slavery, and forms of commercial sexual abuse such as forced prostitution. Dr. Mujeed said factors that lead to trafficking are many and include the following.
This complex crime is driven by 3 interrelated factors that must be addressed simultaneously. Poverty, food insecurity, humanitarian crisis, conflict, forced displacement, violence along with social and gender inequality drives the increase in this crime. Trafficking networks are growing alarmingly and more organized. These crimes are also being facilitated by evolving digital technologies. Artificial intelligence is used by traffickers to enhance existing transnational criminal activity by reducing costs, increasing revenue, and reducing the likelihood of detection. Third, demand for exploitative services of children is on the rise, such as for sexual exploitation online and offline, domestic servitude, child marriage, recruitment into armed groups, forced begging, and forced criminal activities. Conviction for trafficking in children remain low, and perpetrators continue to enjoy impunity. Corruption, stigma, fear, and the lack of protection limit children's ability to report and seek justice. As a result, trafficking in children remains a low-cost and low-risk, yet high-profit crime generating billions of dollars annually.
Governments and their partners, including faith groups, civil society organizations, and human rights organizations, are doing what they can to fight trafficking in children at global, regional, and national levels in many ways, including in enacting and passing tough laws against traffickers, investing in awareness programs and education, as well as in the security for children. But more needs to be done. Dr. Mjidi's office is in the process of drawing up a toolkit to facilitate the assessment of the cost of violence against children and returns on investment in violence prevention.
Responses to trafficking in children are not evolving fast enough to keep pace with the evolution and scale of the crime. But ending trafficking in children is urgent and possible. If we invest more in social and child protection systems, including in humanitarian context, and if we strengthen accountability to end impunity of perpetrator. Evidence-based solutions exist and are outlined in the ICAT call for accelerated action to prevent and end child trafficking. The implementation of this comprehensive and coordinated action, which addresses the multifaceted nature of this crime, is key to ending child trafficking and violence against children, involving survivor and children at risk safely and ethically in the design of anti-trafficking response is also essential to effectively eradicate this crime. Let me conclude with the powerful words of a girl I met recently who was a victim of trafficking. She told, "There is no justice. I am locked in a shelter while the abusers are not paying the price. It is unfair that there are no caught." This call requires an urgent response. We need to act better and faster to put an end to this crime.
Dr. Najat Mala Mujid, the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General on Violence Against Children, speaking there last week to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva. And that was Millennium Appointment for this week. This has been John Baptist Tumusime.
You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.